Der Geruch in una berushutet adokusho nigin yarid in una ijavit kiman no pat biyar kuti garin ne kanak neni ya Inu in ayari mi.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, Captain of the ALT, and I am sitting in Upernavik, Greenland, in a boatyard. It's about 10 in the morning, I guess, finally doing one of these shows when it's not, you know, 4 in the morning. I'm surrounded by a bunch of little fishing boats, maybe, I don't know, a dozen of them, different states of dilapidation. I'm actually trying to get out of the wind right now, so I'm sitting underneath of a fishing boat that has fallen over on its side, and I'm kind of using the hull as protection from the wind. And it's a gray, kind of overcast day. It's been gray for some time now. It's been not much sunlight lately. Kind of been gloomy. A whole lot of crazy stuff's been going on lately. And yeah, so I'm just sitting here drinking a cup of coffee. We're going to be pushing off the dock as soon as I get done with this radio show. We just got fuel. It's actually a really nice thing about Upernavik. Upernavik is sort of the last, well, I don't know the best way to describe it. I hate to say it's the last part of civilization, but when you get north of Upernavik, things change. There are no more seawalls north of Upernavik. You have to drop an anchor. What this means is that if you want to get fuel, you'll have to use a jerry jug. If you want to get water, you'll have to use a jerry jug. The nice thing about Upernavik is it has a seawall, not a very big seawall. I mean, there's only really room for one boat. There's one place in Upernavik where a visiting yacht can tie off. And it's about, you could probably park a 60-foot boat there. And that's where we're tied off right now. The nice thing is, though, that the fuel truck will come around and lower you a hose, and you can fill up all your fuel without having to use jerry jugs. And for the last 2 months, whenever we needed diesel, we had to jug it. And in Connacht, that meant getting in the boat, rowing over to land, filling the jugs, rowing back over, emptying them, going back over, filling the jugs, and, you know, repeating the process sometimes for 6 to 8 hours. It's just, you know, it's just a time-consuming process. You'd spend a lot of time lugging jerry jugs. But anyways, it's good to be back. It's good to be back here for a variety of reasons. We're out of northern Greenland. And south of here, it sort of picks up. So you got Disko Bay, a few day travel from here. It would be less if it was the summertime, but the seasons are starting to change. It's the end of August. Everything changes rapidly in the Arctic. And one of the big significant things that happens this time of year is the sun starts to set. And when the sun starts to set, it really changes how you can work. It changes the whole dynamic of how you operate in the Arctic. Normally, sailing at night is no different than sailing in the daytime in most bodies of water. But when you have icebergs, obviously icebergs are uncharted and there's no AIS. I mean, they're just all over the place. You know, it isn't the big icebergs you got to worry about as much. It's really the little guys. And the little guys can still be the size of, you know, a school bus, mostly buried underwater. It's sort of like having containers everywhere. So you don't want to run into a container at sea, you don't want to run into an iceberg either. So when night falls, you really need to be somewhere, you need to be on anchor. Ideally, you need to stop the boat. Now, I did grab some headlights in the last episode. I was looking for lights, and I made this little light box, and I put it up on our bowsprit, and it's not bad. I mean, you know, it's a snowmobile headlight with a couple of tractor lights attached to it. It actually came out pretty good. I think it looks pretty good, but, you know, it's not like a proper spotlight. It's certainly better than nothing. And if we get caught in a situation where it gets dark and we haven't got into an anchorage yet, it will come in handy. And last year, we did find ourselves several times coming into anchorages as it was getting dark, or damn near dark. But we still, you know, it doesn't get dark till, I don't know, 11 o'clock or midnight still. So we still have quite a bit of daylight, more than 12 hours. And we'll be taking advantage of that going south. I imagine it's going to take, because we have to stop at night now, every single night, it'll take us 3-4 days to get down to Disco Bay, where we can pick up our pressure sensors once again. And then hopefully we'll be in Osyat around, I don't know, the 10th or something. So maybe another 10 days or so, 11 days, 12 days. It's going to take a little while to pick up those pressure sensors. Another thing that happens, of course, when it gets dark is it gets a lot colder. So the night brings in the cold. Also, it gets cloudier. You get a lot of blue sky days in the summertime in Greenland. You know, you get a lot of fog, too. But when it's not foggy, you can get some surprisingly clear, sunny days. And now it's, I haven't seen the sun in, I don't know, a week, I guess. It's just been cloudy every day. And this is sort of moving into that time of year where it just starts getting cloudy. Cloudy and gray and cold at night and dark with icebergs and, you know, the whole ordeal. But it's been pretty crazy lately. It got pretty crazy not long after my last blog entry, radio show, I should say. So we were pushing off and we were going to head south. I believe at that point, I don't remember if we were coming, if I've already been to Etah or if I hadn't been. I don't remember. But it's sort of irrelevant. We went up to Etah, quick recap. That was sort of the prize, you know, at the end of our survey. You know, if we got the survey done quick enough, we'd go up. Etah is about 80 miles north of Kanak. Etah is a sort of base used by various explorers, like Perry, for instance, during the Great Age of Exploration. And it's a very green fjord. It's not a town. There's like one hunter hut there, probably inhabited in the winter, a couple of dilapidated huts. It's really just a fjord, but it's up in Smith Sound. It's about 700 miles from the North Pole, and it was sort of our furthest north. It's at 7819 north, so that's pretty far up there. But like I said, it's only 80 miles north of where we were doing our research. So we get up there, and unfortunately, our timing coincided with one of these adventure tourist cruise ships. You know, Etah or bust had been the motto for our entire expedition. We've been talking about Etah since the boatyard in Sisimiut is being like the, you know, since the very beginning of this expedition, it's been all Etah, Etah, Etah. And we finally get there after working hard and doing the research and months of work and all these hardships, and it's just flooded with eco-tourists like freaking Disneyland. I'm sorry, adventure tourists. They're not eco-tourists, they're adventure tourists. But yeah, I mean, they're building, I just heard the other day, they're building two mega Arctic cruise ships right now. They're going to have like 4,000 passengers each. And, you know, they don't give nothing to these communities. They don't help in any way. I've seen them in some of the little towns. I saw them last year in Siorapaluk, which is the furthest north indigenous settlement on the planet. And, you know, me and Nikki are sitting there, and, we're, you know, the boat's on anchor, and we go for a hike, and we're hiking up this sort of hill. We're not going up to the top of the mountain, because that's a couple thousand feet, but, you know, there's a green slope, and, we, you know, we're the Arctic hare are jumping around, and so we're looking at the Arctic hare, and I don't know, we might be up 700 feet or 500 feet, and I see this cruise ship, maybe this 400, 500 foot adventure. You know, adventure tourist cruise ships are typically not the mega cruise ships, but they will be soon, because now they're building them for the Arctic. But anyways, I see this thing come and drop anchor right next to our boat. And they unload, just like all this fury of activity. And next thing you know, they're lowering all these big black ribs, these big black inflatables into the water. And they're loading them up with the passengers. And in this case, the passengers were all wearing matching yellow jackets, where in Etah they were wearing matching red jackets. But I don't know what it is about this. I guess they give everybody a jacket when they, as part of like the ticket or something, and everybody just wears it. But what it does is it makes them look like an army, instead of making them look like individuals, because everybody's wearing the exact same thing. So all of a sudden you got 12 inflatables, each of them with like 15 people in it, all wearing the same matching jackets, you know, blazing towards the shore at, you know, top speed. I mean, it looked like the landings in Normandy. You know, it was like D-Day or something. It was like an invasion. And this poor little town of Sihor-Palouk has like 50 people, you know, and all of a sudden here comes, you know, 150, 175 adventure tourists. They hit the shores, they jump off, they got their cameras armed, and, you know, next thing you know, they're running around taking pictures of the Inuit like they were monkeys in a zoo. And they don't give nothing to that community, you know? They're not doing anything to help that community. And all they're doing really is taking, you know? They're taking pictures, so they can show off to their, you know, these are very expensive trips, you know? They're $15,000 and $20,000. I mean, these are, the people who can afford to do this are wealthy people. And, you know, and I'm a whatever, that's fine as far as, you know, it's fine to be a wealthy person. There's absolutely no problem in that. You know, if you've made money in your life, then great, you know, I mean, that's cool. But these people don't use that money in any way to actually help the people in the villages or anything like that. They're just showing up, they're taking pictures of them, and in my opinion, like they were animals in a zoo, you know. And at least that's the way it looked to me. And then they, you know, as quickly as they come, they load back up. And that's last year is when I heard them say something about the champagne dinner. Oh, we must be getting back to our champagne dinner. And then boom, they load back up and off they go to their ship to some other unsuspecting little port where they're going to invade once again. You know, and for what? So they can go back home and they can tell their other friends about their adventure in Greenland. And you know, it's just, I don't know. Like I said, the people are all super friendly and they're all super happy. Like, they're super happy to be there. Everybody's smiling and waving and super duper happy. And the people who work on these ships are all sort of, you know, salt of the earth sort of people. You know, they're nice people and, you know, it's hard to be angry at them as individuals. But as a mechanism, adventure tourism in the Arctic and in the Antarctic, it's causing problems too. Because in Antarctica, they're dropping them on the same beaches every single time. And because there's so many people in a place that's not used to having people, you know, you're starting to get damage in those places. Because it's just lots of people walking around and they keep dropping more people. And so, you know, it's harmful to the regions that they show up to. Because it's just these regions aren't used to having that influx of boots on the ground, of people walking around and kicking moss and whatever, disturbing the area, basically. So anyways, we were only there for 24 hours. Some pack ice moved in and almost pushed us up on shore, but we got out of there. And then we headed back to Connacht and filled up with fuel, and then the madness began. Anyways, I'll get into the madness here in a minute after the commercial break.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly from Skipper's Review, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of Glock Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, director of membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
Welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting in Upernavik in a boatyard surrounded by a bunch of half-dilapidated boats, or maybe boats in various forms of dilapidation. There's actually a ton of old fishing net around me right now, piles and piles of old fishing net. Lots of broken wood. There's a broken bottle, broken beer bottle right next to my foot. Some old funky cardboard, some containers, steel containers. And yeah, I'm hiding underneath of a boat that's fallen over on its side, a fishing boat. And it doesn't look like that bad of a fishing boat, really. There's definitely worse looking fishing boats around me. But for whatever reason, this one has fallen over on its side. And they're all, I don't know, they're just abandoned, basically. God, I would love to have some of these boats back in Annapolis, Maryland, back where I'm from. I mean, they're completely impractical. Like, what the hell am I going to do with it? And they're not even sailboats, but they're just the coolest looking little things. They're like the cutest little fishing boats, you know, a little 30, 35 foot. But I don't know. There's absolutely no way to get them back, and what would I do with one back there? But they're really cool looking. So we went to Etah, and we got back, and we went to Conock, and we were really low on fuel. So I think we spent like, I don't know, 12 hours or something that day lugging Jerry jugs. So I was sitting there in the fuel depot, and I was looking at a Danish forecast. I knew a gale was coming, and we were in a hurry because we saw weather, and it was only forecasted at 25 to 30 knots on my forecasts I was getting, and you know it's you can't really trust forecasts at 78 north and that part of the world. There's just no observation stations up there. It's really difficult to get a decent forecast, and it's really the fault of nobody in particular. It's just the way it is up there. I was looking at this Danish forecast, and typically the Danish, you know, because Greenland is controlled by Denmark, usually the Danish forecasts are the best. So we're looking over this forecast with this manager guy, and it looked really benign. It just looked like there was some rain, but it didn't really look like there was much else, a little bit of wind. And so he says to me in, you know, broken English, you know, he says, no rain, just wind. And I'm looking at it thinking, God, that doesn't look right. You know, that's got to be, you know, but the dates were right. I mean, you know, but anyways, I'm thinking, all right, well, you know, it's going to blow a gale. So we motor over, and we had a place we were trying to get to, which we had waited out a couple storms before, but we couldn't get there in time. It took too long to fill up, and it's no fault of anybody. It just takes a long time to make, you know, 7 and 8 runs with Jerry jugs in a rowboat. And so we had to pull off and anchor somewhere else. And, you know, the spot itself seemed fine. It wasn't that deep, and I don't know, it seemed like a good enough place. And it would have been a good enough place, but anyways, we dropped an anchor, had a movie night. Movie night is like a thing on the boat. And I never watched Shrek before. I never really wanted to watch Shrek, to be honest. But anyways, they said, oh, yeah, you got to watch this movie. So we watched Shrek. And I guess it was all right movie. But the wind picked up through the night. 30, 35, 40. None of this was that abnormal. You know, we had you know, I think we had 4 other storms at this point on anchor that were between 40 and 60 knots. And when it was 60, it was, you know, blowing us off our anchor. And only one of them really was that bad. But, you know, 40 to 50 knots was fairly normal. And, you know, so whatever. So it was blowing, and it just kept picking up, and it was picking up stronger and stronger, and the anchor was still holding. And eventually I got up, and, you know, in the morning, and it's hard to sleep through this because the boat heels over like, you know, like you're under sail, even when you're just on anchor. But I got up and I went to the bathroom, and you could say that I was caught with my pants down because I was on the toilet when I heard Nicole, you know, yell out that, you know, we're dragging anchor. Again, you know, we've drug anchor in every single one of these. I mean, I had a giant 70-pound Rachna. I think technically it's a 72-pound Rachna, which is a really good anchor. A Rachna is the latest next generation, you know, it's the latest, greatest anchor. I have a bunch of 3/8 chain and then a bunch of 5/8 road on top of that. So, you know, I got a really heavy ground tackle for the boat. And we still have been dragging. And, you know, it seems like it's good to about 50 knots. Once it starts blowing over 50 knots, it just starts dragging anchor. But anyways, whatever, no big emergency. We drug anchor before. So, I come out there, and the wind's picking up in a hurry at this point, you know, and it doesn't take much, you know, only a few minutes, and now it's blowing hurricane strength. You know, it's blowing 70 knots and more and greater. And it's not like, oh, crap. So I throw the engine on, and I tried to use the engine a bit to ease the pressure on the anchor, and hoping the anchor would just catch again. And I looked down the road about 20 feet down from the bow roller near the surface of the water. I see we're using 3-strand anchor road. I see one of the 3 strands break, and the 3-strand starts to like unravel in front of my eyes. I'm about to yell out to him, And we need to get this road back on board, you know? We need to get this road back on board past where this thing is breaking and clean it off again. But within, I don't know, before I could say it and make a plan, the line broke. And there we go. We lost our anchor. We lost all of our chain. Well, all of my primary chain and my primary anchor. I have a backup, but it's not nearly as good. And it's blowing 70, 75, you know, 80. I mean, it's blowing hurricane strength. And it's a complete whiteout. It's becoming a complete whiteout at the very least. And I'll explain that more in a second. So, oh shit, you know, you lose your anchor. We're heeled way the hell over at this point. I mean, when these gusts hit us and we didn't have the anchor to sort of stabilize the boat, I mean, a boat is leaning over like 30, 40, 50 degrees. It's leaning over so far that water is pouring into the pilot house, which, you know, it's like, oh crap. And I'm trying to maneuver the boat and I'm trying to get some control of the vessel, and I'm bringing the engine up to 3,000 RPM. You know, I'm putting it wide open, and I can't, even with the engine wide open, I can't get the nose of the boat back up into the wind at 70 knots. You know, it's just too much. Hurricane strength winds are just a whole nother beast, and there's no way you're going to get your nose of your boat up into that kind of wind, even at full power. And then we end up stumbling across a series of uncharted rocks. These rocks were, I mean, you think about a rock sticking out of the water or a rock hiding below the water, you're probably thinking of something that's a few feet by a few feet or something. These are almost like little islands, maybe 20, 30 feet, you know, about 20, 30 feet just below the surface. For whatever reason, I didn't notice, some of the waves were sort of breaking all over the place, but I didn't notice breaking waves in this area any more than any other area. And typically that's the sign of rocks under the water. That's what you look for when you're in uncharted waters, or even charted waters for that matter, is you look for anomalies at the surface. So if you see an area where there's a lot more waves breaking than anywhere around it, then you assume, okay, well, there's a rock underneath there. But it didn't look any different. All of a sudden, we're going along, just not long, you know, a couple minutes after the anchor line breaks, and bam, bam, we start coming down on these rocks. And, you know, there's a good deal of wave action, so the waves are picking us up and bam, slamming us right down on these rocks, and picking us up and slamming us down on these rocks. I have a steel boat, luckily, thank God, and my keel is the thickest part of the boat. So, you know, it's slamming down on this rock, slamming down. I'm, of course, throwing it. I'm in full 3,000 RPM, and I'm trying to use the wave action, so when the wave picks the boat up, we move a bit forward before it slams us back down. And so we do this. We sort of slam down on a rock, move a few feet forward, slam down on the rock, move a few feet forward, and we get off that one. And okay, we're off. And then just a few seconds later, boom, we're on another one. Same shit again. Coming, slamming down on the rocks, slamming down on the rocks, slowly working our way over, like we're going over these little underwater islands, basically, these, you know, these big rocks. And we went over three or four of them like that, and just pounding and pounding and throwing it and forward and trying to get over this. And of course, there's a serious threat right about now. And we were about, at this point, maybe a half a mile to three quarters of a mile offshore. I was pretty surprised that these rocks were there. It's far enough offshore. You know, in these fjords in Greenland, you can be in 1,000 feet of water when you're a half mile offshore. You know, it gets deep really quickly. So I was really surprised that we came across these things. And because of all the chaos, and there's so much white foam on the surface of the water, like you couldn't see. Normally you could also see rocks of this nature because of the brown spots or the black spots in the water. You know, you sort of can see a different color of water. But we couldn't see that because there was foam. You know, the wind was whipping the water into foam. Foam was everywhere. So yeah, so finally, you know, we get over these rocks, and you don't know if there's another one coming. You know, you just, your boat eventually sort of, you know, stick straight up again, and well, you know, the wind was still heeling us over, but we weren't on these rocks. And you know, had we got stuck on the rocks, we would have been, the waves and the rocks, the wave action, it would have just pummeled the boat. We would have been dashed upon the rocks. You know, it would have been a really, really bad situation, and it already was a bad situation that was getting worse. We got off the rocks, and I wasn't sure if there was any damage to the hull at this point. and there's no real way to check it because it's still blowing hurricane force and there's still chaos all around you. I have a steel boat, like I said, and that gave me a little bit of insurance, made me feel a little better about the situation, and I don't think I really got any damage from it. But we get out of that situation, and we get a little further away, you know, get some distance from land, and God knows where other rocks might be at this point. I mean, you have no idea. It's uncharted waters. You just sort of do your best. So I sort of head back another direction, the opposite direction of where we hit the rocks. And we must have went over some sort of shoal, you know, an uncharted shoal or something. We got hit by a wave so big that it knocked the boat down, you know, which means that it put the masts in the water. It's a really interesting thing to be knocked down in a boat that has a pilot house. Because you're in your pilot house, and your boat goes all the way over on its side, and all of the windows on one side of the boat go underwater. And so you're sitting there, I was like holding onto my mast, and my feet were kind of like up against the wall of the boat, because the whole boat had been inverted. And you're basically looking down at the ocean, you know, it's all, every window on one side of your boat, everything is underwater. And of course, water is pouring in various places and whatnot. It almost rolled over. The boat almost rolled upside down. It stayed there for just a few seconds, maybe 3 seconds. And I could feel like it trying to make up its mind. You know, like, am I going to roll over? Am I not going to roll over? Like, it was so close to that point of gravity and ballast and everything. It was just teetering on the edge, you know, just a tiny bit more, and the boat would have rolled upside down. Unfortunately, a boat like mine is a really bad boat to roll upside down because of the pilot house and just the way it is. A normal sailboat, you know, you could roll it upside down and it probably will roll back over again, especially if you got a deep draft, a lot of ballast to displacement ratio, and a fairly watertight companionway. But I don't have any of those things. So anyway, I'm sitting there for about 3 seconds. I'm just, please roll back over. Please roll back over. Please roll back over. You know, I'm saying that. I'm saying that out loud to my boat. And it did. It rolled back over again. And so at this point, I decided we need to deploy the parachute sea anchor. I had talked a whole episode recently about parachute sea anchors. I don't know if I jinxed myself or what, but hell, I ended up deploying it. And I couldn't do exactly as I wanted to. Had it been blowing, you know, 40 or 50 knots, I would have sailed out with a tiny bit of jib around to the backside of some islands and deployed it there where I had a lot longer to drift. I had a long ways between myself and a lee shore. But in this case, because the winds were so strong, because they were hurricane force, and because we were surrounded by ice, and because it was a whiteout, the rain was so strong, and the wind was so strong, the wind was whipping the surface of the water into clouds of mist. And we've seen this quite a bit before, and I've talked about it before, where you get these 60-knot gusts, and they come down, and you can see the wind coming, because there's this big, giant, misty cloud coming right at your boat. But it was so much of that that it was like kind of like being in a blizzard or being in incredibly heavy fog. It was complete whiteout. It was just like you were inside of this cloud of mist because it was whipping the surface of the water so badly, you know, so much because the wind was so strong that it was just foam. You know, the whole surface was covered in foam and you had breaking waves, and then you were in this like heavy rain mist. And you just couldn't see anything. So had we had tried to sail around the islands, we would have been careening down these waves at top speed, and we had icebergs all over the place, and we wouldn't have been able to see the icebergs because of this lack of visibility. Even the radar was struggling with this. It was so much water in the air that the radar wasn't really working very well. So there wasn't really a good option of trying to sail the 10 miles or so to get to the backsides of these islands and then deploy the parachute sea anchor. We just had to deploy the parachute sea anchor right there and then and sort of hope for the best and try to figure out what we were going to do from there. So anyways, I got to go to a commercial break and I'll talk about what we did from there.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Hi, I'm Dave Dempsey from Marine Intelligence. If you're the owner or captain of a superyacht, then you know how expensive internet can be. And yes, it's a ripoff. We've made it our mission to revolutionize the world of marine communications. We will find you the best price for your internet by comparing all major vendors. And we do that for free. That's right, no charge to the boat. It's a free service. We get you the best price for your yacht, whether it's just one boat or a fleet of boats. And all the savings will be passed on to you. We can save you over $1,000 US per meg. So stop doing what you're doing and visit marineintelligence.net now, before you forget.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to science, education, and exploration. I'm sitting in a boatyard in Upernavik, in Greenland, about 72 north. My boat is tied off to a seawall, like a bucking bronco right now. Swell is coming into the harbor. We're jumping up and down the seawall, but I'm pretty well secured and ready for it. And as soon as I get done with this radio show, we're going to push out to sea and try to get 40 or 50 miles south before the sun sets and anchor behind some island, some little uninhabited island or whatever. So anyways, everything's going crazy. The shit's hitting the fan. It's blowing hurricane force. We lost our anchor. We just bounced over a whole bunch of rocks. And so we deploy the parachute sea. I tell you, all right, let's get this parachute sea anchor out. Now, in retrospect, there is a mistake I made here in some ways. I have deployed parachute sea anchors so many times I can do it in my sleep. I mean, I've spent about maybe 25 days on parachute sea anchor if you count all the different times I've deployed one, you know, combined. At one point, I spent 10 days on a parachute sea anchor north of the Bering Straits in the Arctic Ocean going around the Americas. So, in two big vicious storms on the Alban Vega. So, for me, it's no big deal. And I always imagine that had we deployed a parachute sea anchor on this trip, that I would be the one who's deploying it. And since I've done it a lot, it's, you know, sort of second nature. And this is a really oddball situation to deploy a parachute sea anchor. But because of the situation, I had to stay at the helm. We had these rocks that we had just bounced over on one side of the boat. We had an iceberg on the other side of the boat, and it was whiteout conditions. Every once in a while, the wind would ease up for a second, just long enough for me to see the iceberg or see the rocks, and it would come back again, and everything would get blanketed. And so I was doing my best at 3,000 RPM to try to keep the boat going. And I tell my crew how to do it. I say, you got to put a fender on a trip line, or else you'll never get the thing back again. And that's, so I tell them, we have this big spool of line, 500 feet of line. It's on a spool, a giant spool. Pretty self-explanatory how to let line out on a giant spool. But unfortunately, my mate, I have a mate, I have a cameraman, and Nicole, the scientist, and, you know, my mate, whose really job it is to help me, he was starting to panic. And so he put out the parachute sea anchor, but he didn't put on he didn't put a fender on the trip line, which means now we were never going to retrieve the thing ever again. And in the panic, some of the line got wrapped around itself, and like three strands of the line, they all got wrapped and tangled. So he threw it overboard and whatever. I mean, I understand, you know, I wasn't making a big deal. Like, I didn't really care at that point if we weren't going to get our parachute sea anchor back. I just wanted to stabilize the vessel. And once the parachute sea anchor hit the water, and it was relatively shallow water, you know, we're still at only maybe 70, 80 feet or something. But, you know, you can deploy a parachute sea anchor in that. And all of a sudden, the boat put its bow, you know, back up into the wind and the waves, and the boat stabilized in a pretty big manner. And that's what the whole point of a parachute sea anchor is to get the bow back up into the wind and waves and really stabilize the vessel. We were still getting knocked around a lot. The boat was rolling over one way or another way. But we had another issue, and that is that the parachute sea anchor, a boat on a parachute sea anchor does not drift, and I was wrong about this the other day. It does not drift at the same rate as an iceberg. So you the iceberg drifts much slower. So we were drifting down on icebergs. And basically, you'd get dashed upon an iceberg no differently than you'd be dashed upon a cliff in a storm. You can imagine if it's a storm, you got big waves, it's blowing hurricane force, your boat goes up against a cliff, that's the end. And it's no different with a big iceberg. They're cliffs of ice. So I found that with the engine on, I could slowly push the boat and the parachute sea anchor at about one knot over to one direction or another. So I could actually kind of slowly avoid icebergs as long as I could sort of see them coming. And every once in a while, like I said, you'd get the wind would die down long enough where I'd see an iceberg and it would pick back up and it would, everything would go white. But that was enough for me to basically know where it was. The engine overheated at this point, which is like, oh shit. But it just needed coolant. It was just being worked too hard. So I threw it open, I threw some coolant, I poured a bunch of water. You can use water in a pinch if you need to. So I grabbed a bottle of water and dumped it in there and closed it up, and okay, the engine's working again. It wasn't overheating. But when my mate had first deployed this parachute sea anchor, I asked him what happened to the excess line, because I saw there was excess line, and he said, oh, no, you know, it's fine, and I said, well, I don't see it, and he just walked away from me. He went down inside the cabin. He was panicking at that point, and he grabbed the satellite phone and went down inside the cabin. And maybe 15 minutes later, I see the line under the boat, this excess line under us. And it's pretty long enough to wrap around the prop. And I stick my head down. He's downstairs. I'm up on the wheel. And I stick my head down and say, there's a line under the boat. We need to get this line up right now. It's going to wrap around our prop. And I'm looking at him right in the eyes. I mean, he can hear me. And he's panicking. He's calling. He's at the satellite phone. He's calling the meteorological office in Greenland, trying to get a weather forecast. It was all pointless. You know, I couldn't get him to come up and help me, basically. He was frozen. He was panicked. I mean, he's an amateur sailor, you know, and this is part of the problem. I had a professional sailor lined up, well, semi-professional, to come with me on this expedition. It was a guy who was about the same age, late 20s, but he sails for a living. He crews on boats, on sailboats. This is what he does. But, I don't know, friends and family talked him out of it or something. He changed his mind. 2 weeks before he was supposed to leave on a trip, he bails on me, basically, leaving me in a shitty situation where now I don't have any crew, I don't have a mate, and so I ended up having to take somebody along who, this guy is a marine archaeologist who's in his late 20s, who probably never really faced death before. And at this point, this is probably the first time in his life where he really realized, oh shit, I might die today. Or this might kill me. This situation might kill me. And if you've never experienced that before, if you've never been in a situation where it's like, oh shit, I might die, you know, a lot of people panic. It's sort of like the first time being in battle, maybe. I don't know. But I've never been in a battle. But I've been in enough storms, and I've been in other situations where I thought this might kill me. And so I don't panic in these situations. But he was panicking. And instead of helping me save the boat, I kept yelling it over and over. I kept saying, we got to get this line in. We got to get this line in. It's under the boat. We got a line under the boat. I couldn't, you know, I would have ran out there myself and pulled the line in. Although it's blowing hard and waves are crashing over the boat, that's what, you know, we have tethers and we have harnesses. Put a harness on, connect it with a tether. It's the wind is so strong, you can't walk out there. You got to crawl on your hands and knees to get up there with waves breaking on your head, you know, icy waves breaking on your head. But you're not going to die. You're attached to the boat with a tether. You just go up there, pull the line in, it would take you a few minutes. I would have done it myself, but I couldn't get anybody to take the wheel. On top of that, we had, again, rocks on one side and iceberg on the other. It was a really tricky situation. I was trying to slowly push this boat away. We were really being threatened by an iceberg that was right behind us. And, you know, we all would have died, and you know, had I not been able to get away from it, because we had been dashed upon it. So I wasn't in any position to leave the wheel. And he was panicking. So I yelled it a bunch of times, and I couldn't get him to do it. And, you know, I can't expect the cameraman to help. And Nicole, at this point, was getting immersion suits and life raft and a ditch bag together. You know, I told Nicole, get the immersion suits, get everything together. And so she was busy doing that. I don't know, about 5 minutes maybe 7 minutes later, the line wraps in the prop, and the engine dies. And our situation has just gone from bad to a whole hell of a lot worse. At least it was bad, but it was under control. Now it's downright dangerous. Because now we're drifting, we have no way to control the boat, the engine is gone, and and we could drift right down on an iceberg. And get in your life raft, sure, but your life raft is going to be blown downwind into the iceberg no differently than your boat is. And your life raft will be dashed upon the iceberg just like your boat will be dashed upon the iceberg. It's not an option. So it's a real shit situation to be in. And but luckily I had got just far enough away from this berg behind us that when it died, we almost drifted on it. We came just a couple hundred feet from it. I mean, we drifted right by the damn thing, but luckily I had got enough distance from it that by that point when the engine died that we didn't get killed by this damn iceberg. And this is the situation. I mean, this guy was so busy, this mate was so busy basically trying to call distress and trying to call people on his sat phone, basically trying to save himself, that, you know, the safest thing to do is try to save the vessel. You know, by saving the vessel, you are saving yourself and along with everybody else. But in those moments of panic, people just, get me off this boat, get me off this boat, get me out of this situation. That's all they're thinking, you know, and that's, has a problem with sailing with amateurs. But anyways, at this point, I said, all right, we need to make a distress call. You know, this is just... And about 100 miles from there is Thule Air Base. And the Danish keep a vessel there, a Navy ship there. It's about a six-hour trip on their boat, because their boats go pretty quick. So we called up, got the Danish Navy to come over and give us a tow. And so for the next 6 hours, I made everybody put on immersion suits, got the ditch bag ready, got the life raft ready. It was all sitting in the pilot house, ready to go. And but we were at the mercy of the wind and seas, and you know, because the parachute sea anchor was deployed, we were in no risk of the waves anymore or the wind. You know, it can blow hurricane force, it can blow 70 knots and 80 knots or whatever, but you know, with the parachute sea anchor out, you're all right. But I mean, you're getting knocked around a lot, but it's not going to kill you. But the icebergs, we were at mercy of being drifted down. We were going by icebergs. It was pretty damn sketchy. And I was pretty pissed, because this mate, all he could talk about is abandoning ship. It's like poison for everybody else, because all everybody else was thinking about was abandoning ship, you know. And it was just all, oh, I'm gonna abandon ship no matter what happens, and all this sort of shit. Just like, and he was puking. Alexander, the cameraman, was puking. Alexander was puking in his own hat. I mean, people weren't even puking overboard or in the sink. People were just puking like in the boat. Everything, the boat, the floor of the boat was just covered in crap. Like there was, you couldn't step anywhere without stepping on shit. You know, like the whole boat was just covered in shit. There was water sloshing all over the place. And it was just a shitty situation. Eventually, about 40 minutes before the Navy vessel comes, the wind just drops down. And when the mate was on the phone with the meteorological office, he told me that it was going to blow. They said it was going to blow 60 knots for the next 24 hours. Well, that must have been bullshit, because it blew for, you know, it blew maybe, I don't know, 70 or so, but it died after, you know, right before the Navy ship showed up. And it died quickly. All of a sudden, it was down to like 25 knots, maybe 30. Now I'm telling people, look, we need to start thinking about saving the vessel. Like, the wind has died. It's absolutely ridiculous to abandon ship in 25 knots of wind. And that's what I was saying. And all this mate could talk about is abandoning ship. Oh, abandon ship. And then he had poisoned the minds of everybody else. Everybody else was just thinking about abandoning ship. And I'm trying to rally everybody. Like, look, we need to save the ship. You know, fuck abandoning ship. Let's save this damn thing. And everybody was just, I don't know, it was... Anyways, a Danish vessel, naval ship, came over, and I made sure I was the one who talked to him, because I didn't want him on the VHF talking about abandoning ship. And I said, look, you know, hey, can you guys throw us a line and tow us behind these islands and, you know, and go from there? So they did. The Danish ship came over, it threw a line, basically, well, it shot a line at us with some kind of line-shooting cannon thing. And we pulled a tow line on board, and it towed us around about, I don't know, 12 miles or so. It towed us for, maybe 12, 15 miles. And then we were behind the island, and we had a lot of protection from the seas. And they helped us. They had a diver. They helped us go down and cut the line off. I wanted to cut the line off myself. I had an immersion suit. I wasn't going to abandon ship even if they wanted me to. I was going to let the Danish take everybody else off the ship. I was going to put, you know, I already had my immersion suit on. We were all wearing immersion suits. I made everybody put their immersion suit on, you know, the whole time that we were waiting for the Danish. We were wearing immersion suits. I was going to jump overboard and try to cut it off. And I figured, hell, if the Danish saw me jumping overboard in these sort of seas with, you know, I'd tie myself off to the boat, but they weren't going to, you know, maybe they would help. So anyways, that didn't have to happen. They had a diver. A diver went down, cut the lines off the boat. They invited us on board their boat. They gave us a hot meal. It was really nice. They were great people. They were all super friendly. They gave us a spare anchor to couple with my spare anchor. I have a claw, a Bruce claw anchor that I use as a spare. And then the next day, we anchored, another storm came. It only blew about 45, 50 knots, maybe 40, 50 knots. We had some stronger gusts. We drug anchor about a half a mile in that storm, but there was no emergency. And you can imagine everybody was sort of on edge at that point, because we just went through this nasty situation with all this craziness, and now we got another storm coming, and we lost our primary anchor. So we're using like two spare anchors that I rigged together in one long line, but we made it through it without a problem. And my mate was still freaking out. Oh, we need to try to haul the boat out in Connacht, which is absolutely impossible. You can't haul a boat out in Connacht. There is no way to do it. There's no facilities. There's no nothing. So I'm dealing with a kind of a broken crew. Spirits are down. Everything on the boat is wet. All sorts of stuff is broken. People are really shaken up. Luckily, we had a good weather window, and we got ourselves down Baffin Bay. The engine broke shortly on after that. Luckily, I had a spare injector pump. The RPM was erratic, and we had to duck in. We had to limp our way into this cove with really strong currents and icebergs everywhere, and the engine kept dying and again threatening that the current would bring us down on icebergs. And luckily, I got in there. We dropped this anchor, and about 12 hours. It took me about 12 hours to change the injector pump. A lot of pressure, because you imagine, if I don't change this injector pump, we're screwed. We're stuck in this little tiny place in this little cove in the middle of nowhere. Luckily, I have the ability. I know how to change an injector pump, but it took 12 hours. We all got covered in oil, and it was all messy. But the engine worked. We motored 350 miles in pretty calm weather, and now we're down in Upernavik. So yeah, it's been flipping crazy. My mate is leaving in a few days. He's leaving. I was going to fly him out of Upernavik. I was really pissed off that when I needed him, he just panicked. And, you know, had he had grabbed that line and brought it on board, the whole situation would have been different. You know, it would have been we never would have had to call for distress. But, you know, instead, when I needed him the most, he panicked. And our situation went from bad to a whole lot worse because of his cowardice, basically. But, you know, what do you expect? He's an amateur. I doubt he's ever faced death before. A lot of people would panic in that situation. So I try not to be too hard on him. But he's going to be leaving in about 10 days when we get to Assiut. I got a new crew member coming in. And then we're going to sail back to the United States. We only got 3,000 miles to go. And we got to cross the entire Labrador Sea in October. It's going to be nuts. But anyways, I got to go. You can see the website, theoceanresearchproject.org. And you can always make a donation on the website. Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you next week.
Kuenna kaasi. Kuenna kurao. Kuenna ikkilasi. Kuenna ushua.